The Off the Ball Podcast Network. Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now then, we're joined in studio by Paul Rouse, Professor of History at UCD, author of Sport and Ireland of History, and also more recently The Hurlers. And we're very blessed that he's with us. Hello.
Hey Joe, how are you?
Coming through the rain. What's it like out there, Graham?
It's actually lovely.
Yeah. So in about, 4 or 5 weeks, when Ireland embark on their 5-match running streak, all of us will be seeing the William Webb Ellis Cup brought into schools around the country, this being rugby country. William Webb Ellis.
Team of us, Joe.
Yeah, well, listen, indeed. You're here to talk to us about William Webb Ellis and the legend of William Webb Ellis. I'm sure people listening know you've been in to talk about the history of various aspects of sport. The World Cup is on, so we thought, what better time? So, rugby school. Have a plaque up.
Yeah.
This stone commemorates the exploit of William Webb Ellis, who, with a fine disregard for the rules of football as played in his time, took the ball in his arms and ran with it, thus originating the distinctive feature of the rugby game, AD 1823. So this much I know and most people know about William Webb Ellis. Picked up the ball, boom, rugby.
The chrysalis moment. And, of course, the competition currently on is playing for the William Webb Ellis Cup and has been since its inauguration in 1987 as the Rugby World Cup, which is a magnificent way to honour the founder of the game with the slight difficulty that it's all rubbish.
Of course it is. As if William Webb Ellis was the first person who picked up the ball and ran with it in one of these mad, disorganised games.
We actually don't even know if he ever picked up a ball and ran with it.
Okay. He's a real person.
He's a real person. Should we talk about what he did do first rather than what he didn't do?
Yes, 100%.
Very quickly. So William Webb Ellis was from Salford in the north of England, near Manchester. He was born in the early 1800s. To a father who was a commissioned officer in the British Army. His father died when William was young, fighting for the British Army on the continent, and William Webb Ellis was raised by his mother. Where the story comes into the rugby issue is that he was sent to rugby school. Now, rugby school was one of the growing elite schools of England in the early 19th century. These were the schools like Eton and Harrow and Winchester, which were expanding during these years to stock the expanding British Army, or the expanding British Empire. So this was to be the clerical officers and the officers of the army and everything were produced in these schools and sent around the empire to run the world. Now, Ellis went there as a scholarship boy. Generally speaking, rugby was not the elite of the elite. That was Eton. It wasn't the sons of the aristocracy, or there were a few who went there. It was largely the sons of kind of prosperous clerics and well-to-do businessmen, so people of money, but not the absolute elite. He graduated from that school in the 1820s, went to university, just as you would expect someone of his time to do. And while in university, he played cricket, was good enough to play play in a colours match before it became a colours match, and then became a Church of Ireland clergyman. And as a Church of England clergyman, he had a diocese in London for many years, and he was a writer of distinction as well, and he wrote a couple of books, including one which was called Dangerous Errors of Romanism, which he published in 1853, which is most likely an attack on Roman Catholics, but I can't find it. And then he published a collection of his sermons in 1838. So he then emigrated, spent a lot of his time in Europe, died in 1872, leaving a fortune of £9,000 behind him. He'd never married. He left it to charitable causes and to his his sister-in-law. Okay. At this stage, he hadn't invented rugby.
No, so I did a little bit of reading, but not much. It was only 4 years after his death that he was credited with inventing rugby.
A man called Matthew Bloxham, who was himself from rugby school and who had been there, even though he was a couple of years ahead of William Webb Ellis, he hadn't been in his class. He wrote a letter to the Rugby School magazine in 1876 to say that William Webb Ellis had picked up the ball and run with it for the first time in 1824 in his first letter, to say that, and therefore he'd invented a game called rugby. Why did he write the letter at that time? He wrote the letter at the time because there was a debate in England about what the true form of football was. Association football had been founded in 1863. The rules for soccer laid out and was gathering pace, not in the 1860s. The association football, the FA, nearly collapsed in England in the 1860s. But in the 1870s, it was gathering momentum, and because of the FA Cup by 1876, it was really prospering. So there was now a debate over what the real form of football was. Mm-hmm. And Rugby School wished to claim it for herself, and more pointedly, Meteor, the school publication, published this letter by Bloxham, which Bloxham then published again a couple of years later, but he changed the date now to 1823.
Okay. And how popular was rugby around this time when they were trying to fight for supremacy?
Oh, it was massive. Rugby was bigger than soccer in the 1870s and 1880s and into the 1890s. There were bigger crowds attending the Rugby Challenge Cup finals than there were attending the FA Cup final, which was the major competition at the time, bigger even than the league, until the early 1890s. So rugby was huge.
And did this bloke who wrote the letter saying William Webb Ellis did this thing imagine that there was a certain romance about the story, or what was the value in it for rugby?
It was almost entirely about class. This was about claiming ownership of a game for a particular set of people. Because the spread of rugby in the 1870s and the 1880s, the story of that spread is it spread through the working classes of Lancashire and Yorkshire in particular. So in Lancashire and Yorkshire, almost 50% of all the rugby players in the country by 1890 were based in Lancashire and Yorkshire, and they were all working class people.
So it was almost an effort to say, well, one of our type invented this game.
It was entirely an effort.
It belongs to us.
It belongs to us to say that. Like, you must remember, a lot of these ball handling clubs, which had been founded in the 1850s and 1860s, were the products of public schoolboys initially. Mm. And none of them, or almost none of them, joined the Football Association when it was founded in 1863. But they didn't then set up the Rugby Football Union. They didn't do that until the 1870s. And then the contest began between rugby and soccer as to which game would be the dominant game in the last couple of decades of the 19th century in England.
I presume, though, that attributing the invention of rugby to William Webb Ellis, aristocratic and all as rugby school was, that couldn't have had any tangible effect, really, could it, on who played the game?
None. Absolutely none. What had a tangible effect on who played the game was a split which emerged in rugby. And this is where the story of William Webb Ellis becomes important. That split happened in the 1890s, and it was a split over class and money. And what happened was, in 1885, soccer had professionalised, and rugby was utterly resistant to this. After 1885, rugby set about writing down a code of rules, really enshrining amateurism, what it meant to be an amateur. And this led to a series of show trials, basically, about clubs and players all across the north of England who were accused of essentially getting paid for playing the game, of having fake jobs in order for them to play, and of getting what was called boot money, where brown envelopes were put in their boots or cash was just put in their boots after games, after they had appeared. And this happened through the late 1880s into the early 1890s. Show trials, full transcripts of them still in the newspapers. A man who got a wedding gift from people in his club, that man gets banned from playing rugby because it's seen as a form of giving him stuff. So they become these high priests of a really narrow amateurism.
Yeah.
In which no money can be given to anybody, there is no give on it.
Which plays into the aristocracy being the ones who can play it.
The then president, or one of the then presidents of the RFU, said in the early 1890s, if the working man cannot afford to play the game, he shouldn't play it. He should do without it. So this goes on and on through the early 1890s, but there's pressure.
Is it a wonder people have a problem at rugby?
There's pressure in the north of England, though.
Yeah.
Because these are working men who work in factories, and there's a call, and motions are put to the Rugby Union Annual Congress, 1892, 1893, saying we must allow what were called broken time payments. That is to say that if somebody misses work because of a match or a training session, that they are allowed 6 shillings or 8 shillings, whatever it is, as compensation for their missing. Not that they will be paid just for playing the game, but they receive broken time payment for it.
And would these matches have been for the likes of Leeds and Bradford and all these teams?
It's all those clubs that you now see if you watch rugby league matches.
Yeah,
and the inevitable split came in 1895,
okay,
when because there was no give in the people who ran the Rugby Football Union, no give whatsoever in terms of allowing certain, a certain discretion.
Yes.
Around how people would be looked after.
And were these people running at the aristocratic types down in London?
Oh yeah, but not just in London. It's tempting just to say this is South of England against North of England, but it's not really.
Okay.
Because also around Manchester and Leeds, there was an elite public school graduates who were running the industries. And of course, Manchester, those conurbations of the North of England were hugely urbanised, hugely industrialised, and very wealthy people up there as well, working in the law and working in various parts of business. And they had an affinity more with people of their own class as they saw it. I mean, you cannot get away from the divides of class in 19th century England, arguably in 20th as well, in 21st. But certainly in 19th century, it was absolutely clear. But it led to a split organisation in 1895, the establishment of what was called the Northern Union, first of all, but later became known as Rugby League, who first of all allowed for broken time payments, and then within 3 years allowed for open professionalism.
And when they broke away and started giving broken time payments, did they also change the rules then?
They began to change the rules very quickly, but you must remember rugby was changing already in terms of its rules through the 1880s and 1890s. Originally, a try in rugby was worth only 1 point, and it was about got the ball down, come back out, and you got your points for kicking it over the bar. That was considered to be the great skill, and kicking from open play was considered to be the skill. Slowly in the 1880s, it goes to 2 points, and then in the early 1890s, it goes to 3 points for a try. So the game was beginning to change anyway, and it went from 21 a side down to 15 a side. So that matters. But what happened in rugby league very quickly is that they went down to 13 a side, and they moved away from the idea of the scrum. Mm. They thought there was nothing more boring in rugby than the scrum, that this and the games split. They are in very many respects they look like the same game, but rugby union became about the contest for the ball and the contest for turnovers in play. Whereas rugby league developed a set of rules whereby there would be no scrums, meaning really just a way of restarting the game. And if you were tackled, you were down and you healed the ball. So it's about run. They try and put a premium on running and open play immediately.
Yeah. And presumably the rugby union types thought, well, our game involves far more strategy and prefrontal cortex thinking and intelligence and
yes, and it was rooted in the public school system.
Okay.
And immediately the old Rugbyan Society set up a committee in 1896, just after the split happens. And they consider all the evidence for the origins of rugby.
Okay.
And the only thing that they go with in the end is the letter from Matthew Bloxham, which was found in the Meteor magazine as published in the 1870s. Bloxham was by now dead, not there to be questioned on it. Not one single shred of evidence was put beside this.
Wow. So it's entirely plausible if you said to William Webb Ellis on his deathbed, guess what? And 140 odd years, they'll be playing for the Rugby Union Trophy based on your name.
It may have been a surprise, I think it's fair to say.
So he wasn't walking around William Webb Ellis in the final years of his life in the late 1860s and early 1870s thinking, you know, I founded rugby, I created it. That wasn't his thing.
Oh, absolutely nothing to do with him. There is no record of him claiming anything to do with rugby football. Absolutely no record. And this is a story which is mythologized. I mean, every sport has its own origin myth, and they put around, like, baseball invent a story that it was designed by Abner Doubleday when he decided one day to etch a baseball diamond behind a tailor shop in Cooperstown, Upper New York. Complete rubbish.
Yeah.
But the Hall of Fame for baseball is in Cooperstown, upstate New York, and major league matches, played there, everything.
So I get, you know, when you talk to people and William Webb Ellis comes up, everyone says with a wry smile, oh yeah, he invented rugby, and nobody believes it. So in 1987, when they decide to name the World Cup trophy after William Webb Ellis, does nobody say, taking it a bit far? We name it after something.
You have to
real?
Remember how it's done and what's happening. Okay. Despite resistance, in particular from the Irish and Scottish rugby football unions, it's clear at this stage that there is a drift towards professionalism in rugby. So this is, it's like the last sting of the wasp. You know, we're branding this as our sport. Mm. And as it's clear, by 87 it's clear that rugby, all the conditions are in place for rugby union eventually to professionalise. Indeed, if you look at somewhere like Wales, Australia, New Zealand, there are people already getting paid essentially for playing rugby, and in Wales always had been.
It's amazing actually professionalism held off that long, 100 years really from the split.
It is extraordinary given the international context, the amount of television interest in the 80s and the fact that there was a global market. I mean, it's a narrow global market and it's not like soccer.
Sure.
But it spans both hemispheres.
Yeah.
And it gave rugby an outlet which allowed it to professionalise in the way that it had. And the model, by the way, for the Rugby World Cup, Rugby League had been there 30 years previously with its own Rugby World Cup. I mean, Rugby League is a little bit caught, it's a little bit stuck as a sport in terms of how it can spread itself. Mm. And Rugby Union seems to be, despite all the talk about its desire to spread itself by holding a World Cup in Japan, the manner in which second-tier nations are treated is deplorable.
Mm. Yeah, very similar to cricket in the way there's tier one, tier two.
Very similar to cricket and arguably very similar to hurling in how you have your elite set of teams and people make all the right noises about wishing to spread the game. But really, when it comes down to it, is there true endeavour to spread it?
Yeah.
And if there is true endeavour, like look, for example, the way Tonga are treated in rugby and the manner in which their players are given scholarships to go and study in New Zealand, schools in New Zealand when they're young and then they get taken on there. And the manner in which South Sea Islanders in general, because of the economic circumstances in which they grow up, are basically their prey for stronger unions. Look at the way the Romanians are treated here, the Georgians, the Russians. Look at how long it took Italy to get involved in an expanded Six Nations competition. Look at how difficult it is to put a Nations League in place and the resistance to any sort of promotion or relegation from that Nations League. The genuine idea that it should spread, is that really there?
And why the resistance?
It's a union. It's a really short-sighted decision by individual unions to prioritise their immediate income over the long-term demands of spreading the game and a willingness to do that. And if we're really honest about it, and I know that this is a really unpopular point to make, but the reality of it is that if you look at the international teams that are fielded at the moment and the manner in which there is a willingness to field people from other countries, it is somewhat farcical.
Mm. I can't remember who I heard. I heard someone the other day making the argument that actually when you look at the players they have at the World Cup, Fiji are maybe the best rugby country in the world.
It was a really interesting thing happened at the last Rugby League World Cup, and that is that players could declare to play for a country in the last Rugby League World Cup, but we're not thereafter pinned to play for that country. So, for example, players in Australia who are of Samoan heritage played for Samoa in the Rugby League World Cup, got to the semi-final, could have won it, beaten very narrowly by England. But those players, are many of them second-generation players from Australia, those players can now go back and play for Australia if they want. There's a kind of a... There's a flexibility around eligibility rules.
Yeah. And did league spread from England then to, you know, it's big in Australia?
Yeah, it professionalised in what happened was it happened around touring teams, and a touring team of New Zealanders was invited over to play against the Northern Union because, of course, there was a massive gate. Like, rugby league was hugely, hugely important to the urban communities in the north of England, and it drew in huge crowds during this period. And rugby union in England got stuck. So England was the dominant country in rugby union before 1895. Winning almost all of its matches against against Scotland, Ireland and Wales. Mostly it won. But after 1895, between then and the outbreak of the First World War, England lost more matches than it won.
Okay.
Because, of course, it lost that swathe of northern clubs who were the power of the team. They were in the forwards. And the number of rugby union clubs in it who were affiliated to the Rugby Football Union in England halved after the split.
And would it be, without wanting to overly generalise, which is always a kind of a risk with these kind of things, but would league today still be more affiliated with the working class?
It's considered to be something that's much more rooted in the communities of the north of England still. It hasn't managed to spread itself. It has managed to spread itself bits and pieces, but it hasn't really managed to push itself beyond the confines of its heritage.
Yeah. William Webb Ellis, does he have any Irish connection? You were saying he might?
Sort of Kildare connection, is that what you're...
I have no idea. I'm literally working off that footnote from you.
There is a brilliant article that was written in 1946 was published in 1946 by a man called General Owen O'Duffy. General Owen O'Duffy might be known to those listeners who are interested in history, as being the founder of the Blue Shirt Movement and a kind of a soldier in the Irish War of Independence and generally interested in sport. He claimed in an article which he wrote, which was published in 1946, that William Webb Ellis was actually born in Ireland when his father had been stationed in Tipperary. He wrote, "My theory is that the Tipperary lad," meaning William Webb Ellis, "was consciously emulating Gaelic footballers he had seen in his homelands, and that rugby, like soccer, is thus another anglicised form of an Irish game." It's really, really difficult to know where to begin with that, except to say that there's a slight difficulty with the thesis, I suppose, and that is that if William Webb Ellis had been born in Tipperary, he would have left before the age of one. Now, we will accept it that even the most bellicose of Tipperary men, and the world has known a few, would not claim that by the age of one their children are versed in local sporting habits.
I wouldn't have thought so. But then this is rugby country after all, so who's to say?
Is this niggling away at you, Joe, this rugby country?
No. But I mean, it's been incredible the last few days. Even Dan McDonald in here, a very reasonable fella, likes most sports, he was saying he struggles to connect with the rugby team the way they're marketed.
I think it has irritated a few people, people who really like the game and who really want the team to do well. I think it has annoyed a few people, and I think the general sense that rugby is marketed at international level to within an inch of its life is a bit irritating to people.
And do you find it a bit irritating?
Do I find it irritating? I kind of ignore it.
Yeah.
If I'm Malachy Clarkin wrote a brilliant article on it last weekend. After last weekend, he had the Tipping Point column in the Irish Times on Monday, and he was just talking about distinguishing between the game and what goes around the game.
Mm. Yeah,
and I would agree with him. I would aspire to agree with him.
So, is there anything else that we should know about William Webb Ellis or this whole venture when the trophy's lifted in 4 weeks and we look at it now with a new informed kind of understanding of just how ridiculous it all is, especially that he himself had no idea this was all being said about him?
The only thing I would say is that the tour of rugby school is a really good thing to do. It's a really interesting thing to do. You can see the playing fields where lads played, you can see the original plaque, and you get a tour in which you... The time I did it was admittedly 15 years ago and more.
Right.
And the person who gave the tour claimed that rugby.
They were there when William Webb Ellis lifted the ball up.
Gaelic football came from rugby.
Right.
Australian rules came from rugby.
Yeah.
And they also made the point that Baron de Coubertin says that he was kneeling in the chapel in rugby school when he was visited with the idea of founding the Olympics. They only stopped short of claiming to have invented the horse.
It's a hell of a school. Because I would have thought, actually, when you just think about it, that rugby would have come before football. You know, the instinct, if you're with a kid, a kid might just pick up a ball and run around with it and whatever, but actually refraining from picking up the ball might come afterwards.
There is no wider folkloric record for a form of football in England which doesn't involve almost always catching the ball and carrying it and moving it.
Yeah.
All the folk football that we know, broadly speaking, fits into that category. And indeed, the first rules for soccer allow for a catching of the ball coming to you on the full when you pull it down and kick it. So this is a manufactured
it really is.
Distance. And what's really interesting, a really interesting question to consider, and that is, if rugby had professionalised when soccer did, would it have become the dominant game? Because it was dominating soccer in the 1880s. It had far bigger crowds and a bigger spread of clubs.
Your sense is quite possibly.
I don't know.
Although then
I don't
soccer
know.
Is so popular the world over.
Yeah. Soccer is easier spread than rugby is, so I would be really slow to make that point.
Okay, but the notion that everybody, no one had even thought to pick up the ball, and then this lad came along and said, "Has anyone thought of this?" It is the more you think about it,
it's so crackers. It's so crackers that it could only draw people's attention, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a certain romance to it as well, though. It's a good story.
Well, when you see it, though, they should change the name of the trophy.
Should they?
Yeah, of course they should change the name of the trophy.
Has it not gone on too long now, though? What are you nominating?
I wouldn't be equipped to nominate, but you could call it. I did see someone say call it after John Olomou or somebody like that. You could call it after a heroic figure within the pantheon of rugby greats. Although that is a very crowded arena.
It is. It's very connected in my mind with Nelson Mandela, I must say.
Well, do worse.
Yeah. No, I think that ship has sailed. William Webb Ellis it is. Listen, thanks so much for coming in. Paul Rouse, a professor of history at UCD. Thanks, Paul.
My pleasure, Joe.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.